AM 1290 and 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio WHIO and Sim Trainer Indoor Range and Firearms Training Center present Shooting from the Hip. Straight talk about firearms, ammunition, self-defense, when and where you can carry, legislation, and legal issues. All about safety, training, and so much more. Your hosts are Jeff Pedro and Mark Avery. Jeff is a 24-year veteran police officer, currently assigned City of Kettering Detective, and owner and lead instructor at Sim Trainer. Mark is a retired Air Force officer, senior staff instructor at Sim Trainer, and NRA-certified instructor in multiple disciplines. They're here to bring to the microphone the truth about guns. Join them by calling 457-1290. Now, Shooting from the Hip. On AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome our listeners to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's first indoor shooting range and firearms training center. You can come see us at 2031 2031 Dryden Road in Moraine. If you care to stop by the shop and see what we have to offer, or you can visit us on the web at www.sim-trainer.com, or you could call us at 937-293-3914 and see if we can help you with any of your needs as far as the shooting sports or firearms training, anything of that nature goes. I want to encourage our callers to call in today at 457-1290. That's 457-1290. I want to kind of devote the airways in the show today to your comments, your concerns. I know there's a lot of things going on right now that I think are distracting a lot of people, particularly some of the things that are going on in Washington. It's kind of preoccupying the news. It has relevancy directly and indirectly to what we've been talking about here, and I'm sure that it's stirred up quite a bit of controversy around the country and certainly in the local listening areas. So if you have anything you'd like to get on the air, I want to offer you the opportunity to do that. Mark and I were just talking before the show about some additional legislation that we just want to bring to your attention, and I'm just going to yield to him at this point and let him talk a little bit about a new Senate bill that's been proposed and has some pretty decent proposals that might help fix some of the problems that exist in current law.
Thanks, Jeff. One of the bills that we've talked about for some time now on the show is House Bill 203, which would change the concealed carry provisions in Ohio law for those who go into a restaurant when the restaurant has a license to serve alcohol for consumption on premises. The way the current law is, if you want to go to a place like Applebee's or any number of other restaurants that serve alcohol, even if you don't consume alcohol, it's a felony for you to go through the doors. And that really makes no sense at all, because it means that I could go to McDonald's and have a hamburger and fries and something to drink, like a soda or water even, and I'm perfectly legal. And then I go across the street to another restaurant that, just because they serve alcohol, even if I'm not consuming, it's now a felony for me to go there. So we talked back in June when House Bill 203 was introduced with one of the authors of that bill, Representative Jared Martin. And that bill has made some progress through the House. And then a couple of weeks ago, when we talked to Ken Hansen about the things that went on with the McDonald case, the oral arguments in the Supreme Court, he mentioned briefly at the end of the show that he had spent several hours speaking with folks in the Ohio legislature, and that there was some legislation that was possibly going to be coming out with respect to with various issues. But one of them is, again, restaurant carry. Well, that bill was introduced this last week. It's currently in the Senate Judiciary on Criminal Justice Committee, and that committee is chaired by Tim Grendel. There is Senate Bill 239 is the bill, and it has several changes, including the restaurant carry provision. It will allow you to do the same thing as would be the case under House Bill 203. It has one other provision as well, and that provision changes the car carry. Ohio has a very convoluted set of rules and requirements for people who have a license to carry a concealed handgun, and they're in a motor vehicle. You can. There's only one of four possible ways that you can carry. You can carry in a holster on your person. You can carry in a closed glove box or console. They both have to. It has to be able to close. Have some sort of a closure on it. You can carry in a case that has some sort of a closing mechanism, like a zip, snap, or buckle. And you can carry in a locked case, and that does not have to be in plain sight. If you carry in a case that closes, then but does not lock, that case has to be in plain sight. And that is the case provision was added because a lot of women want to carry in a purse, and there was no legal way for them to do that because it was not a holster on your person and it didn't lock. So the provisions for a case that closes, has some sort of a closure, were added to the Ohio law. But the bottom line is none of these requirements make a whole lot of sense because they're not going to change the way a law-abiding citizen, and that is the definition of someone who has a license to carry a concealed handgun, they're not going to change what a law-abiding citizen is going to do with that firearm. They're not going to be any more responsible because they have complied with the arcane requirements of the Ohio law. So those requirements, if Senate Bill 239 gets passed, then it would simply remove all of those restrictions. And if you have a license to carry concealed handgun, you can carry a handgun in your on your person or in the motor vehicle in whatever way you deem appropriate. There's a lot of people, for example, that want to carry in a pocket and not use a holster. Jeff and I have discussed this several times, and we've talked about it on the show. And frankly, we don't think that's a real good idea. The holster provides a measure of security, a measure of repeatability and reliability in your ability to draw the firearm. So carrying in a holster, we think even if you're going to carry in a pocket, it's a good idea to use a pocket holster with that. But there are some people who carry firearms that they don't think they want to carry in a holster. And some revolvers, for example, especially a small snub-nosed revolver that has a double-action hammer. Frankly, as long as you don't have anything else in the pocket, and it fits your pocket properly, it's probably not going to be a problem. I mean, in most likely, and there are thousands of people that have carried firearms that way long before the current concealed carry provisions. People carried pocket holsters forever. So it's certainly understandable why some people would argue that, we've been doing this for years and there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that now. If this new provision gets into law, then that would be the case in Ohio.
Yeah. A couple things I want to just expand upon that Mark brought up there. As a law enforcement officer, I think it's key to note that this whole issue of interpretation of the convoluted law is not only a problem for civilians, it's also a problem for law enforcement, quite frankly. I'll give you just a couple examples. One that just recently was brought to my attention by a police officer who said, well, I had an individual who, because of his size, felt more comfortable taking his paddle holster off of his person and just laying it in the open console in the center of his vehicle. Well, technically, by letter of the law, that would be an infraction, and it's ridiculous. Individuals, because of the way you have to wear a seatbelt and the way the gun rests on your hip, it might be more comfortable for him to have it ready at hand right there in that open console area, because some of the consoles don't have a closing mechanism like Mark was talking about, and that puts somebody in a gray area unnecessarily. Now, I want to also mention that I would hope, and this goes out to all my brother and sister law enforcement officers out there, that rational, reasonable decision-making will prevail when they come across law-abiding citizens with concealed holders licenses who do things like that. The unfortunate reality is there may be just that one person who comes across an officer who interprets the law literally, and as a result of the literal interpretation of the law, that law-abiding citizen becomes, at least in the short term, a criminal. And I think that's terribly unfortunate, but it happens in several areas. But this is one where I think that if this language can clean up the law and law-abiding citizens can carry without unreasonable restrictions, it's going to make it better for both sides. The other point I want to mention there is, remember, the criminals don't care about the law, so they carry it any way they want to. Typically, they'll carry it under the front seat, under the driver's seat. They'll carry it tucked in their waistband. They don't have licenses. Those are the ones we're worried about. The law-abiding citizens aren't the people that law enforcement need to be too concerned about.
And putting all of these restrictions on the law-abiding citizens is not going to change the behavior of the criminal. It simply is not. We've seen that over and over. Just in the last news update at the top of the hour, Charles Van Sant reported that there was a holdup in Beaver Creek at the Fifth Third Bank on CJ Drive. That's right near where I live. As it happens, Fifth Third Bank has a corporate policy that they will put no gun signs on the doors. So if that person went through that door and held up that bank with a firearm, they violated the sign that was on the door. Now, I don't think there's anybody that thinks that a criminal is going to pay attention to a sign like that and say, oh, I guess I better go rob some other bank because, look, there's a sign on the door that says no guns here. Oh, shoot, I'm going to have to go somewhere else today. It's just not going to happen. That's insane.
That's exactly the case, and that's proven time and time again. As we had Chief Beal from Dayton talking just a couple of weeks ago, he mentioned the very same thing.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll go out. When we come back on the show, we'll talk to Barbara in Riverside, who has a question for us, and we'll take your call at 457-1290. You're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Cam Edwards from NRANews.com, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and with Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. We welcome you to the show, and if you'd like to get on the show, give us a call at 457-1290. That's 937-457-1290. For those of you who are listening on the internet, and I know there are quite a few out there who do, let's take a call. We haven't yet been to the phones this hour, and we like to do that as soon as we possibly can. Let's talk to Barbara in Riverside. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question is about gun registration. I want to buy a gun and not have to register it. I'm afraid if the government registers all guns, they will someday say, turn them in.
Fortunately, because you live in Ohio, there is no gun registration in Ohio. So you don't have to register it at all.
Even if I go buy it at a store?
Well, there's a difference between what happens when there's a background check conducted and the registration of firearms. And let me explain that just briefly. When you go to purchase a firearm from a federally licensed firearms dealer, then there will run a background check. And the background check that is run is an instant background check. That check confirms that you have no felonies on your record and that sort of thing, anything that would prohibit you from owning and possessing a firearm. But the only information that's kept about that transaction is the dealer. There's the date in which it occurred and the transaction number, that the confirmation number that is given back to the dealer who makes the check. There's no other information kept about that. Now, I know there are a lot of people that don't believe that, but here's the evidence that I submit to show that that really is in fact the case. If for some reason someone tries to purchase a firearm and they are refused the being able to purchase that firearm and then appeal that rejection, every time they buy a firearm, and oh, by the way, when they appeal the rejection, they find out that, yes, it's perfectly all right and that the name was confused with someone else or it's a junior-senior thing or there was, you know, some sort of an issue that's on the record, but it really doesn't apply to them. And so when they go back and do a deeper check into the background, they find out that that person really is not prohibited from owning a firearm. So every time they go to buy a firearm and the background check gets run, that same result occurs, that they would be rejected or they would be refused the ability to purchase a firearm. And every time they go through that appeal process, the same result would occur, assuming nothing else has happened in their life that would make them prohibited. If it were something that the FBI could keep the information and say, all right, we've already found that this person is not a problem, so let's just mark their record and say that person's not a problem. That would save them a tremendous amount of money and grief because from then on, they already would have done the background check and they no longer would have to go through that appeal process, which is, it costs them time and resources and that's money. There is a voluntary appeal process or where you can have a voluntary appeal file created that says, FBI, look, I've done this before. We've been through this drill. Why don't you just keep the information? So it is possible for an individual to tell the FBI that it's okay for them to keep that information, But if they don't tell them that, the FBI does not keep any information about the individual. All they keep is the fact that a background check was run, and this is the date it was run, and here's the confirmation code that was given to the dealer. Now, the dealer does have a record of the transaction, and they have to keep those records for 20 years. And it is possible for the ATF to come and look for a specific piece of information in those, but they can't take those records away. They can't make copies of them and just keep records of them. And there is no registration that goes with them. Now, that's not the case in all states. There are some states that do require every firearms transaction to be reported to some agency in the state, and then that agency keeps a database of every firearm and who purchased it and that sort of thing. But that is simply not the case in Ohio.
Does Indiana have that law?
I'm not as familiar with Indiana laws, but I don't believe they do either.
Okay, if I go to the gun show, do I have to go through that background check?
If you purchase a firearm from a federally licensed firearms dealer, yes, you will need to go through that background check. Now, if you purchase from an individual, then you don't. You don't have to purchase. There is no requirement for that. I would hope that you would purchase from somebody that you know well and that you know their background, so that you're not running the risk of buying a gun that might have been used in some illegal way. But there is no requirement. Now, there is a requirement that if you're a resident of a state, that when you buy a firearm, regardless of whether you buy it from a dealer or whether you buy it from an individual, you must purchase it from someone else of your own state. In other words, if you live in Ohio, you can't go to Indiana to buy a handgun. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. Well, it doesn't make sense to me either, but that's what the federal law is. So you can't, just so you understand what that requirement is, if you can't purchase someone who is a firearm from someone who is a resident of another state, even as a federally licensed firearm dealer like Sim Trainer is, we can't go to Kentucky and buy a gun and bring it back with us. Okay. Even from another dealer. All that we can do is go to them and say, we want to buy this gun. They have to ship it to the address on our license, and then we can take possession of it that way.
Okay, what if it was given to me from someone in Indiana? It was given to me.
Well, in that particular case, it's inheritance, I would imagine, is what you're talking about. The law specifically states transfer, to my knowledge, doesn't make specific provisions for inheritance of firearms. The safest way to do that is to transfer that firearm from Indiana to Ohio and then take possession of it here in the state. We're going to go ahead and go to a break. We come back, we're going to take your calls at 457-1290. You're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Rachel Parsons, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and you're on Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and with Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. We are from Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's premier and first indoor shooting range and training facility. We have several classes that will be coming up, and we'll talk about those a little bit later. But let's go out to the phones right now, and let's talk with Paul in Dayton. Paul, thanks for joining the show. Paul, are you still there with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes. What I was wondering, if I bought a gun from, from like a flea market or something like that, an unauthorized dealer, how do I know that gun hasn't been used in some type of a violation?
Well, by unauthorized dealer, I assume you mean like something like a private sale, somebody who's not actually a federally licensed firearms dealer.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me just mention that when you get involved in a situation like that, there's nothing illegal about you purchasing a firearm from an individual who is not an authorized federal firearms license holder. However, what you want to make sure you do, you have an obligation to make sure that you take reasonable steps to make sure that the information that you obtain and ultimately the information he obtains is accurate. That's all that's really going to be required. There's no provision of law that specifically addresses that transfer other than that it be reasonable in many regards. What I suggest to you when you buy a gun from somebody other than an FFL, you simply get their name, address, phone number, and that way you have a record of the fact that you purchased it. Because I will tell you, if you later run into law enforcement, let's say you decide to carry that as your concealed carry weapon, and you're in a situation where you have to use it, and they take it for evidentiary purposes, and they run the serial number, and it comes back that it was stolen. Well, obviously, you weren't the one that stole it, and they will obviously confiscate that gun, and the original owner has a right to that gun and to have it returned to them. So you're going to want to have a paper trail in place so that you can explain where you purchased that gun. I just had that happen about just before Thanksgiving this year, where a probation officer had actually purchased a firearm at a gun show from a private individual, and he was involved in an incident. And when they ran the check, because we're not allowed to run checks on guns for private individuals, nor are law enforcement officers allowed to run checks on guns they purchase from private individuals, so he really had no way of knowing that. And the person he bought it from was a legitimate person. It's just that the person that person bought it from had stolen it. And we were able to, through the course of investigative efforts of multiple agencies, determine where that was actually taken from and link one of the possible suspects back to that crime. But it was only because the individuals took the extra step and got information from the person they purchased the gun from. So in short, just try to get reasonable information from the person you purchase a gun from to protect yourself in the event that something happens down the road.
The other thing is that, as we mentioned in the first half hour, you need to be aware of what the requirements are for purchasing a firearm from a private individual or from anybody. And the main thing is that you have to purchase from someone who is a resident of your own state. So if you have a driver's license and that person has a driver's license and you're both from Ohio, then that pretty much answers the question.
All right. I had bought a gun 40 years ago. So I don't recall, you know, it was from a flea market. And well, I don't know who the guy is.
And I'll tell you, 40 years ago, a lot of guns were purchased at flea markets and at hardware stores and a lot of different places. And there's obviously no way that you're going to check. And there may not even be records on file still if there was an incident that occurred that far back. And again, it's your own personal weapon. Or you just keep that for yourself. If you decide to pass it on to another individual, just get the information that you pass it on to so that if it ever becomes an issue, you can at least assist in that regard. But I will tell you that you think of the millions or tens of millions of guns that change hands in this country. Very, very, very few or very small percentage of guns result in guns that need to be tracked through the system for criminal activity.
Yeah, they're just not used that way.
Uh-huh.
And 40 years ago, of course, the major changes that occurred in 1994, in 1986. So you're well before that. Those were the two major law changes that that would affect the ability to transfer firearms. So you predate that with a 40 year ago purchase.
Oh, okay, great. I just wondered if I happened to got stopped and they picked the gun, would they keep it because I didn't have paperwork behind it?
No. There's no there is no requirement that you have paperwork for the transfer. It's just a question of it's a good idea to have at least some idea where you got it and to know who you're purchasing from.
True. Okay. I appreciate it. You got a good show going.
Great.
Thank
well,
you.
Thanks very much for calling. And let's move out to Centerville and talk to Warren. Warren, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
What is your question?
I'm going to be moving from here in Ohio to Colorado.
Okay.
So what laws do I need to be concerned with in transporting my guns out?
Well, when you're moving from the state of Ohio to the state of Colorado, if just the move is the issue, you're going to store those guns in a safe case, unloaded, of course, and you're going to transport them in whatever vehicle you decide to transport them to. And then you get them there safely. You'll be able to keep them in your residence. In the state of Colorado, I will tell you that if you're able to go to a couple of different locations, but if you go to the ATF website, and Mark will give you the actual site information, I just want to tell you something. I'm looking at a manual right now anticipating your question, looking at all the state and municipal ordinances relative to firearms. Now, the edition I have is from 2007 because they always run a couple years behind, but they're fairly consistent with a couple law changes. Colorado, interestingly enough, has about a page and a half to 2 pages of laws compared to California that has about 25 pages of laws, and they're very restrictive, but it seems that Colorado is pretty much, I'm going to use the term, wide open. There may be some local municipal ordinances that possibly could come into play, but then with some, as a result of some recent federal legislation, that may or may not be applicable. And I encourage you just to do some research on the internet and try to get that information and see what might be specific to the state of Colorado. But as far as transporting your firearms out there just for your own personal ownership benefit, you're not going to have any problems.
Oh, I appreciate that.
The ATF website is at atf.gov, and you can download both the federal laws as well as the firearms laws for all the states. And as Jeff mentioned, that sometimes does lag a little bit behind reality just in the time it takes for them to get that published. Another place that you can go is to the NRA Institute for Legislative Action. That's NRAILA.org. And they have a gun laws site there. The gun laws for each of the states, you click on the map and click on the state that you're interested in this case, Colorado. There's no requirement to purchase, to have a purchase permit for rifles, shotguns, or handguns. There is no registration, no licensing of owners. There's no permit. You do have to get a permit to carry concealed for handguns, but other than that, you don't have to have a license or a permit to carry firearms at all, other than for carrying concealed. It is unlawful to carry a firearm concealed about one's person, except if you are in your own dwelling, a place of business, or on property owned or controlled by you, unless you have a license to carry a concealed handgun. And they have a shall issue licensing system. We do not have reciprocity with Colorado, and Colorado does not recognize the Ohio license. So that's one thing that we need to try to get fixed. But otherwise, their requirements are very similar. There's about a 2-page summary on the NRA ILA website for the laws in Colorado.
Oh, that's great to know. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks very much for calling the show.
Yeah, good show.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Let's talk to Richard in Vandalia. Richard, thanks for joining the show.
Well, thank you very much. My question concerns timing for renewing my CCW permit.
Your Ohio license?
Yes.
Okay.
When I first got my permit, I thought it was like a 30-day or a 40-day delay.
Okay.
Is there still a 30-day or a 40-day delay for a renewal? Or is this like renewing my driver's license where I walk in and show them my permit and, okay, it's about to expire and I've got to get a new one on the spot?
It's not quite as fast and easy as it is with your driver's license. You'll need to complete an application. Again, you know, there's fees involved, as is always the case, although the fees are a little bit less now than they are. The renewal fee is less than the new license fee. The main thing is that they still have up to 45 days to issue the license. So it'd be a good idea if you go in, you know, a little before the license expires and complete that process.
Okay, can I go in 90 days ahead?
Yes, you can, but it take a maximum of 45 days by law. And when you get the new license issued, that will be the date that starts your next 5-year window. So you want to get it probably a little bit farther, a little closer to the end than 90 days, maybe more like 45 days or a little less.
Okay.
And you can contact the sheriff's office where you're going to get that done, and they will have that information for you.
Okay.
They'll also tell you what the procedures are. Each of the sheriff's office has slightly different procedures, so you need to contact them, find out what the hours are and what you need to bring. But you will not need to have another class.
Oh, very good.
Thanks very much for calling the show. We're at the we're ready for our last break, so we'll be back in just a few minutes after these words from our sponsors. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro in for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
God bless America. This is your blood brother, Ted Nugent, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
I want to welcome our listeners back to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip. Also want to remind you that next week, interesting event coming up, we will be participating in a live broadcast from the Moraine Home Fair, located at 3800 Main Street. It's the Payne Recreation Center in Moraine from 9 to 3 next Saturday. So we'll be on the air from 2 to 3, but we'll be there much of the afternoon. There's going to have they're going to have prizes and games, and many, they say, up to 50 businesses and organizations will be displaying their products relative to home maintenance, home repair at that location. So if you have an opportunity to drop out there and stop by the booth, we'll be giving away a few prizes ourselves. And the nice thing about that, you're only about a mile away from the range, and you could stop by the home fair, see what they have to offer, and then on your way back, if you haven't been to our facility down on Dryden Road right around the corner, you'll have the opportunity to stop by there.
So those who are sports fans, they're going to have some large screen TVs set up too, so you can, you don't have to miss the game in order to come catch the home show.
That's right. This time of year, I'm sure people are interested in March Madness, so they assured us that they're going to have TVs set up so you can peruse through the venue and also check the scores of your favorite teams. Speaking of the range, I just want to bring you up to date with some of the updated or current training that's on the agenda. We will be starting our second series of handgun 1 through 5 classes beginning Saturday, April 10th. Handgun 1 through 5 will begin. We offer them over this particular sequence will be Saturday nights from April 10th through June 12th with anywhere from a 2 to 3 week break in between. And that's an opportunity for people who have had some of the basic training to find out if they really want to move on to the next level of handgun proficiency.
Yeah, this is a great place for people that are already pretty familiar with their handgun, but they would like to become a little bit more proficient and ready to defend in the case of a violent encounter. Handgun Level 1 is our first advanced handgun series, and it is a prerequisite for all the rest of the courses. You don't have to sign up for the entire series of courses. If you just want to come check out that one course, you can do that. In fact, we have several people that have done that. Come and take that course, Mastering Marksmanship Fundamentals, and then if you decide to move on, you can take any of the rest of the courses in any order that you choose that follows that, but you must have this course first.
Yeah, the importance of that class, in addition to mastering the marksmanship fundamentals, is we work on drawing from the holstered position and reholstering, and then also handling malfunctions, and we get you ready to handle your gun in a real live encounter, and then ultimately, if you choose to go on in the training series, we'll enhance your skills from that point, but that foundational class is very important. Again, it'll start April 1st, about every 2 to 3 weeks on through the middle of June. I'm sorry, April 10th, and it'll go on every 2 or 3 weeks all the way through to June 12th, and we take about 2 to 3 weeks in between each class because we give you an opportunity to practice at the range some of the skills and drills that we teach you in class. So if you have an opportunity to visit our website, you can see those specific dates. Those classes cost $79 each individually, or you can purchase the 5-class package at a discounted rate of $295, which is a considerable savings to you. We also have a concealed carry class coming up on Monday through Thursday, April 12th through the 15th. That's in the evening from 5:30 to 9:30 each night. And then we have another one, a weekend class, coming up on May 22nd and 23rd. That's Saturday and Sunday, May 22nd and 23rd from 9 to 5. So if you have any interest in any of those particular classes, please feel free to stop by, give us a call, or check us out on the web and get registered, and we'll help you enhance your skills.
Let's go back out to the phones and talk to Jeff in Greenville. Jeff, you have a question for us?
Yes, I got a question concerning not being a concealed carry weapons holder. Are you able to carry a gun in a holster?
As long as the gun is visible and you're not in a vehicle, there's no legal prohibition against carrying openly in Ohio. So you don't have to have a license to carry openly. There are some significant disadvantages of that in some cases. Tactically, you give away the element of surprise, and in some cities, you're going to find a lot of people who don't understand that law-abiding citizens have guns also. So you may end up having some additional interface with our constabulary. But it's not because what you're doing is illegal. It's because somebody was alarmed and then contacted the police and said, you know, there's a man with a gun. And, you know, when the police get a call that says man with a gun, they're probably going to respond.
So they don't consider the holster to be concealing the weapon?
As long as the gun itself is visible, no, the holster is not considered concealing the weapon.
Thanks a lot.
This has been a topic that's been debated for a long time now. And again, as Mark mentioned, even though there's no specific provisions of law that prohibit that, common sense says that in order to, unless you're in a rural area, out away from people, you don't want to draw unnecessary attention to yourself where law enforcement come and ultimately, you know, they may take you and take your gun for you from you, at least from a short period of time, until they're able to determine what's going on. So just eliminate that possibility. Get your concealed holder's license, and you won't have a problem.
Thanks for giving us a call. Let's go out to Indian Lake now. Jeff, you have a question for the show. Jeff, are you? Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was wanting to find out, I took the concealed carry course about 5 years ago and neglected to get my concealed carry permit. Is there a time limit that I'd have to take the course again?
Yes, unfortunately there is. You have to have your license, your initial license must be obtained within 3 years of when you had the class.
Okay, that answers that question. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling the show. I'm sorry about the answer, but I'm glad we had it for you. Let's talk to Mike in Vandalia. Mike, thanks for calling the show.
Yes, I know you guys offer handgun classes. Do you guys have ones for, like, your rifles or shotguns?
Actually, our rifle classes are about ready to go online. Both of our instructors, our lead instructors, just got back from being overseas with the military, and within the next 2 weeks, those will be posted. And we're still working on the logistics of the shotgun class.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling the show, Mike. We are obviously at the end of the show, and next week we'll be on from the home show in Moraine. So be back at 2 o'clock. In fact, be at the show well before that and see all the activities that are going on. This is Mark Avery with Jeff Pedro on Shooting from the Hip for AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.